Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 189 for November 2nd, 2011, Pearl Critic. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the big projects, the small projects, the projects you might not have heard of, the projects you might find very useful once you knew about them. That's hopefully the ones that we got, especially like one today. But before I bring on and talk about our guests, let's go ahead and bring on my co-host. It's Aaron Newcomb. Welcome back, Aaron.
Hey, glad to be here.
And you're in the Twit Brick House again, huh?
I'm in the Brick House again, once again in lovely downtown Petaluma.
Sounds exciting. So we have a guest today that's, I think, very relevant for, I think, at least me and somewhat for you too, I guess, as well, since you've been doing some coding in Perl. We have Jeff Thalhammer on today. He is the creator and chief honcho now still for a tool called Perl Critic. Perl Critic takes a look at the source code of your Perl program and complains about things that are likely to be bugs or likely not to be a good style, or, you know, all those sorts of things that are sort of above and beyond. It's, if you're familiar with the concept of lint for C, it's similar in that lint adds on beyond the C compiler to enforce a lot of other things. And Perl Critic's the same way. The great thing about it is it's very tunable, and it also has a good way of referencing things that are in this Damien Conway's seminal book, Perl Best Practices. So, I understand you do some coding here, and you're actually curious about Perl Critic today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm kind of a Perl hacker. I don't, and I mean that in the sense that my code is poor. I use Perl. I learned Perl a long time ago. I kind of taught myself how to use it, and I use it a lot to do like parsing. The last thing I did with it was I parsed a custom XML file, and I needed to take that and parse it and get some values out of it and then throw it into a CSV file, a comma delimited text file. And so I was able to use Perl to do that, and it worked really, really well, but I'm sure that my code looked awful to anyone who actually does this, like yourself, on a regular basis. So I'm actually anxious to see what this will do. I don't know what it would do with my code. Probably shout in all caps, you know, this is horrible. But no, it'll be really interesting to find out what it could do for someone that's kind of a casual user like me, casual Perl programmer.
So it sounds really great, Aaron. We'll go ahead and bring Jeffrey on in a moment. But before we do that, I have an important announcement to make. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated Sync App Link. Sync App Link enables you to control select apps from your smartphone with simple voice commands while you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. With Sync App Link, you can do things like voice control Pandora in your car. Listen to your tweets with OpenBeak just by asking with a simple voice command. Once your smartphone is linked to Pandora, for example, you can use voice commands to select your favorite station or make a new one. Bookmark songs to purchase. Give songs a thumbs up or thumbs down. Some of the voice commands include PlayStation Classic Rock, Bookmark Song, Thumbs Up, or Thumbs Down. And with OpenBreak, for example, you can simply say Read Timelines or Read Replies. Sync App Link is built on the API platform that allows Ford to continue to work with developers in the app community to bring apps to life with voice in their vehicles. Voice-activated Sync App Link is available in the 2012 Ford Fiesta. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology. And Ford is helping to bring us together at our studio with upcoming barbecues. Twit Sunday barbecues are scheduled for Sunday, November 13th and Sunday, December 4th, starting at 1:30 p.m. We'll have a chance to meet, eat, and maybe check out some new Fords, too. And you'll have seats to watch us record Twit in studio. If you'd like to join us, please go to twit.tv to request tickets. We'd love to see you here. And thanks to Ford for bringing us the Twit Sunday barbecues. Aaron, I suppose you'll probably be able to go to some of those barbecues, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I'll come over and maybe I'll bring over my paper rocket launcher or something if there's room, and we can launch some paper rockets all over Petaluma. I'm sure they'd appreciate that.
So let's go ahead and get our guest on the line. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Randall. It's great to be here.
Hey, good, good. You know, it's sort of weird actually seeing you through Skype because when last we chatted, I was seeing you in person down here in Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah, I was. I just happened to be in town. My wife's from LA, so I decided to drop in and visit the Pearl Mongers there.
Very cool. And where are you speaking to us from today?
I'm in my living room here in San Francisco.
Okay, so not too far away. Same time zone. In fact, actually, you probably could have gone up to the Twit studio and been up there instead.
Indeed, I could have.
But it all works anyway. Anyway, so enough chit-chat about locations and relative parsings. Now, I actually, having attended your presentation on Pearl Critic, I think I did a fairly good job of introducing Pearl Critic at the opening. But go ahead and give us sort of the 30,000-foot view of what Pearl Critic's all about.
So Pearl Critic is a static analyzer. Programming languages have had a long history of static analyzers. Each language has its own. C has lint. It's probably the most famous one. Java uses findbugs or PMD. What static analyzers do is they look at your source code and they find inconsistencies or bugs or things that just don't agree with the standards that you want to program against.
So these are things above and beyond, say, what the language requirements would be. So, I mean, like, in order for something even to be compiled by the C compiler, it has to be within the C syntax. So what is lint finding that the C syntax isn't enough to drive? And I guess by that means also then what Pearl Critic is doing as well.
So much like lint, Pearl Critic, there are rules that you might want your programmers to follow, which extend above and beyond the language rules, the syntax rules. So, for example, with Pearl Critic, you might want to forbid programmers from using the two-argument form of open, for example. The two-argument form is, it compiles, it's valid syntax, but it has security problems and introduces some potential bugs. So, as an organization or as a developer, you might declare, well, we never want to use that two-argument form, so we want something, a tool to enforce that we always use the three-argument form, and that's exactly what Pearl Critic does.
And so just in history of Pearl, I mean, Pearl's been around for over 20 years and has gone through a number of revisions. And so what you're talking about there for people who don't know Pearl is that, or they're familiar with this particular syntax, is that the original form of Pearl had a very flexible second argument to open. The first argument, of course, being the file handle name, but the second argument had, like, you know, you'd use less than, greater than, double greater than to indicate, you know, read from, write to, append to. And over time, that got more and more overloaded with more and more features. And it turns out that there's some slight security risk interactions between these sets of very complex open strings and what you could get from, say, a command line on something that would process a series of files. And so what you've done in Pearl Critic has allowed me to recognize when I've used that two-argument form of open to warn me about it. Now, how do you recognize that thing? It's not just running a regular expression over the output of or over the source code of Pearl, is it?
Well, it could. That's usually the first step to a static analyzer is understanding the code as text. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, Adam Kennedy has done a little better. He created PPI, which stands for Parse Pearl Independently. The old saying goes that only Pearl can parse Pearl, and that's still mostly true, but PPI gets pretty darn close. It can, through its own combination of regular expressions and a tokenizer and lexer, it can take a piece of Pearl source code and turn it into a document object model, which you can then traverse and understand.
Now, by a document object model, you're saying that in the word, like, you break it into tokens, like the word print, followed by a quoted string, with the quoted string would be the next token, followed by the semicolon. So what PPI does is it uses a series of rules and some ad hoc heuristics to sort of figure out what the Pearl program is in terms of tokens. Now, how does Pearl Critic take advantage of that?
So once you've taken your Pearl source code and turned it into this object model, which is, like you said, a tree of things like, of abstract representations like variables, statements, operators, strings, those sorts of things. Well, then you can start to analyze it in a programmatic way, and that's where Pearl Critic comes in. It traverses the tree, and at each node, it evaluates what's called a policy, which is the rule that you want to enforce. So your policy, the job of the policy is to examine a particular node on this document object model and decide if it violates the rule that you're trying to enforce.
So you have these rules. You have a whole bank of rules to start with. Where did these rules come from? Is it just common practice, common knowledge, or I actually know there's a source of a lot of the rules, right?
That is a source of controversy. Programmers tend to be an independent, headstrong bunch. They don't like to be told what to do. And in a large way, that's what ProCritic does, is it tells you how you ought to be writing your code. These rules mostly came from Damien Conway and his book, Perl Best Practices. Some of them we added on ourselves over the years. I'd like to think we have a little bit of wisdom to contribute, but most of them came from Damien's excellent work.
What would be an example of something that came from Perl Best Practices that ProCritic can check for?
One of my favorites is not to return undefined, explicitly return undefined from a subroutine. The reason being for that, Perl has this notion of context, whether you're returning from a subroutine in a scalar or an array context. Now, if you explicitly return undefined from your function and that function is subsequently called in a list context, what the caller will get back is a one argument list containing a single undefined value. Now, in some cases, that may be exactly what the right answer is, but in most cases, that's the wrong answer, because if that list gets evaluated later in Boolean context, then it appears to be true. That single undefined value is true. Whereas if you had just returned an empty list from your function, that would have evaluated it false as false. And that is the more usually the more idiomatic way to handle returning a null value from your subroutine.
So is there a way to customize this then? Because in some cases, I actually may want that result. So is there a way in ProCritic to say, you know what? I'm going to change the way that I handle this, and when I recognize this, I'm not going to flag it as a problem.
Yeah, so there's many ways to configure ProCritic. Usually the first level of configuration is to decide which policies you agree with in general and which ones you don't. So at the highest level, there's about 100-some policies that ship with ProCritic. The first step in deciding how you want to use ProCritic is to usually enable and disable the policies that you don't want anything to do with. Now, the example you just gave, where on a specific occasion, you might like to bend the rules, so to speak, you can add a little comment to your code, which is a specially formatted comment that ProCritic recognizes, that says, leave me alone, don't bother me about this particular line of code, I know what I'm doing.
So, I was thinking as you were describing that, I mean, is this something that's fairly easy for, you know, end users to configure then and kind of set it up the way they want to handle things?
It can become very complicated, but we've tried to make it easy to use out of the box. So straight away with no configuration necessary, ProCritic is usable. We've gone ahead and divided all of these policies into five different buckets based on severity. And this was sort of a judgment call as to what the severities are. But we've assigned them into different buckets according to which ones are the most important versus the least important. And out of the gate, by default, ProCritic only looks at what it thinks are the most important problems. So you don't get overwhelmed by these hundreds and hundreds of errors that might or warnings that might be coming out of your code.
Right.
And from there, once you've sort of gotten comfortable with working at the most severe level, you can then start to tighten the screws down and get more and more restrictive about your code. And the less severe rules tend to be more controversial. They tend to border on sort of stylistic issues, whereas the high severity rules are the ones that we think are either tend to prevent bugs, or they are themselves outright bugs, or are so easy to comply with that there's no real reason not to.
Right. Now, is this easier to write for Perl? You mentioned a couple of comparisons, I think, to Java and C. Is it easier to write for Perl, given that it's runtime compile as opposed to C and Java?
No, it's actually makes things a bit harder. Being a dynamic language, there's a lot of things that can go on at runtime that you can't check with a static analyzer. A static analyzer, by definition, never executes the code that it's actually analyzing. We're just treating it as text. So all the interactions that could happen at runtime when you load a library or interact with a file system are completely out of scope for Perl Critic. With other languages where you have strong typing and you can compile things down to bytecode or machine language, you can do a lot more detailed analysis with those kinds of tools.
Right.
So there's a whole class of problems that are beyond the scope of Perl Critic,
right,
and are still up to human beings to actually look at the code and decide if it makes sense or not.
Right. Before we get too much in, I always like to talk about implementation. So before we get too much further into the discussion, I did want to bring up implementation. So this is a CPAN module, if we haven't mentioned it before, right? So I'm assuming that the easiest way to get started is just to use the CPAN commands to install the module straight up, right?
That's right. Perl:critic is the module. It comes with a command line tool for running it. There's a whole ecosystem of other modules on CPAN that sort of orbit around Perl Critic. There are additional policies that some authors have written. There are also there's also a pragma and a test script that you can install to run Perl Critic as part of your automated tests.
Yeah, and I noticed that when I went to CPAN to take a look at this, I mean, there are a lot of modules built underneath Perl Critic, as you were just saying. I mean, are these all are some of these submitted, I'm assuming, and some of these are maintained by you and others?
Most of them are maintained by the Perl Critic core Perl Critic team. Some of them came to us from other submissions, from outside authors. And we incorporated them into the core. These days, we don't do that so much. We encourage people to ship their own policies and their own distributions. We'd like to sort of see a culture of Perl Critic policies evolve. All the modules within, all the policies within Perl Critic are reasonably consistent with each other, meaning that you can comply with all of them at once. There are other policies out there that are not consistent with one another. So you have to kind of choose between one or the other. And that's what we would like to see is a variety of different policies out there that people can pick and choose from.
Right.
We're not pedantic or dogmatic about what rules you follow. My own feeling and the feeling of the Perl Critic team is that you just be consistent and follow your own rules. And you think about what your own rules are.
So you
and where you go from there. What the rules are is up to you.
So you mentioned the Perl Critic team. Who is the Perl Critic team? How many people are actually working on this?
Well, it's been around about 5 or 6 years now. And over that course of that time, we've had maybe a dozen different people contributing to it. At any one time, there's about 3 or 4 people. Myself, Elliot Shank, and Tom Wyant have been the most active recently. In the past, we had Andy Lester and Chris Dolan. We're involved with it a lot.
Mm-hmm. And then just wrapping up on implementation, so I'm assuming that to use this, I do just that inside my Perl code. I say use Perl Critic like I would with any other module?
No. Actually, the first way... Perl Critic is an application, most of all. You could use the Perl Critic module and its API if you wanted to do something unusual with Perl Critic, but for the most part, you use Perl Critic as a command line tool, and that command line tool does ship with the Perl Critic module. So once you've installed Perl:critic with CPAN, you'll have a Perl Critic command line available to you. And the arguments to that are just the names of the files that you wanted to analyze and it will spit out the violations on standard out, just like your typical command line tool. And then it has a whole plethora of options to control which policies get enforced, where your configuration file is, whether you want the output colorized, that sort of thing. It's a fairly robust command line tool.
Okay. So that sounds pretty straightforward. But then what happens when I do use the other mechanisms within Perl, the use warnings, use strict, those kinds of things within my Perl code? What happens when how do those interact with Perl Critic, or doesn't it matter?
Well, Perl Critic is looking at those things. For example, you mentioned use strict and use warnings. There is a policy that says that you must use strict and you must use warnings. And if you don't have those things in your code, then Perl Critic complains. But Perl Critic is not involved with your program at runtime. Perl Critic is something that you do as an author before you release your code. It's a tool that you analyze your source code with. It's not something that you run your application with.
Right. So that won't change the way Perl Critic analyzes the code, though, right? I mean, if I use those, is it smart enough to recognize that I want those types of structures to be used inside the code?
Not sure I understand the question.
So if I say use strict, for example, will it double up on that? In other words, so I say use strict. Does Perl Critic look at use strict and make sure on top of use what use strict is doing that is it also catching things, or does it just say, well, you said use strict, so we'll just go with that?
I think I understand. So using strict applies a certain set of rules to your code, right, if you will. Perl Critic is a set of rules, is a set of rules on top of that. There isn't any overlap between what Perl Critic looks for and what use strict does. They're completely orthogonal to each other. However, there is a policy in Perl Critic that says you must use strict, for example. So if you want all of your developers to be using strict, that's something that Perl Critic can enforce.
Ah, got it.
But Perl Critic doesn't look at the things that use strict does. It doesn't care. What it does care, though, is whether or not you use strict. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
And one of the things I've been seeing over the years is that people have, you know, being sort of the point man for Perl for 20 years, I've gotten a barrage of people saying to me, well, Perl's just not maintainable. Perl's ugly. Perl, you know, it's write only. It's line noise and so on. Now, would part of the motivation for why you did Perl Critic to be sort of to, you know, defer these fears or at least a answer to them somehow by having some sort of way to enforce a standard Perl that actually makes sense?
Absolutely. The genesis for Perl Critic came about 6 or 7 years ago. And I was working on a large legacy system that had evolved over like a 10-year period. And it was very much like you said, it was spaghetti code. It was read-only or write-only kind of code. And it was exactly the kind of stuff that can give Perl a bad reputation. Mm-hmm. And the culture of the team at that time, we were a diverse group of people with different programming backgrounds. So we all tended to write in our own sort of dialect of Perl. And it was very, very frustrating because every time you had to work on someone else's code, you had to sort of adjust your whole mindset into thinking about, okay, well, how does Susie write her Perl? And then it would make a little more sense to you. And likewise, Susie would look at my code and have to sort of frame her mind as around how I write my code and in order to be able to understand it. And we didn't have code reviews at the time as well. It just wasn't part of the development culture there. So there was no way to sort of cross-pollinate ideas and get people thinking in the same sort of way. And I was really depressed. I was pretty pissed off with Perl at the time, actually. That same year, Damien Conway came out with Perl Best Practices, and I read that up like over a weekend. And I was just blown away. I felt, okay, finally here I have some set of guidelines about how I ought to be doing things. And I can share this with other people and we can all kind of get on the same page. We may not all agree, but at least we have a starting point that, you know, we can look at and talk about and discuss. But like I said, we didn't have code reviews. So I wasn't managing the team or anything at the time. So I couldn't beat these people over the head with Perl best practices, although I might have liked to. Mm-hmm. I wanted a way to share Conway's ideas with them and sort of get a dialogue going about, you know, how best to write Perl. Yes, there's more than one way to do it, but surely some ways have got to be better than others. Then I found PPI and put that together with Perl best practices. Sort of the light went off and I thought, oh, great. Here's a tool. I can use PPI to analyze Perl code and compare it with Damien Conway's recommendation. So I could get an automated code review by Damien Conway with the push of a button. It would cost my team nothing to do this, right? It was fully automated, so we didn't have to spend time talking to each other. It was a way to sort of infect other people with ideas about how best to write Perl at a very low cost, without having to schedule lots of meetings and code reviews and book reviews and things like that, which just weren't part of the culture at the time.
Now, that sounds like an ambitious undertaking. How long did you hack at it before you figured out that you had something that was usable and you could share with the team?
The first, it was kind of a weekend project at first. And at the time, I was something of a junior programmer. My first version of ProCritic was like all in one giant module. And if you wanted to extend it, you had to write more subroutines. And it was typical novice stuff, but it worked. Mm-hmm. And it was enough that I decided to put it on CPAN just because I even if my implementation was shoddy, I thought the idea was pretty sound. So I put it on CPAN. It was the first time I'd put anything out there. And then, much to my delight and surprise, people started giving feedback saying like, you know, hey, this is a great idea. You know, you should do it this way, or here's a twist for you. And I really, that's when my Perl education really started. That's when I learned how to do things better than what I was doing before.
What was that process like for you to get that kind of feedback, though? I mean, you said, you know, you consider yourself a junior programmer at the time, and here you were putting out something that all of a sudden was getting a lot of publicity. What was that like for you?
I was okay with it. It did create pressure, and so I spent a lot of nights working on this and drinking a lot of Mountain Dew, and my wife got a little tired of it at a few points, but I had already sort of realized how much of a novice I was. I mean, reading Perl best practices really opened my eyes as to just how much of an amateur I was and how much more there was to learn. So having all of these people come knocking on my door and giving me ideas and things like that, I was okay with that. It didn't scare me. It really motivated me. Mm-hmm. And inspired me. And that's one of the things I love so much about Perl, is this, the people involved with it make it a really special place to be.
And how much did the actual having to translate one of Damien's rules into code, how much of that influenced how you programmed? Because I guess you had to really understand what the rule meant.
You did. Fortunately, the rules are not that hard to understand. Damien does an excellent job of explaining the motivation for it, when to follow it, when not to follow it. So coding them up can be complicated. But understanding the rules wasn't that hard. Some of them I did Pearl Best Practices is an outstanding book because you learn not just how to write good code, but where Perl comes from. He explains how a particular idiom evolved and what the motivation for it was and why maybe that idiom shouldn't be used anymore or why a particular idiom should be used. It's kind of a bit of a history, and it gave me a lot of insight into why Perl is the way it is.
Although, I have a talk actually called Perl's Second Best Practices, which actually addresses some of the things where I disagree with Damien. And I know that I was one of the reviewers on the original book, and I think there's even a pull quote from me on the back of the book talking about how everybody should have this in their hands and as a place to start. But I think that's probably my criticism now is it's become, at least for some of the clients that I've seen, it's become ritualistic. Like they adopt, we shall do exactly what Perl Best Practices has in it without realizing sort of what you're talking about, that motivation behind it. And like one of the things I keep seeing over and over again, for example, which is more distracting than useful, is people putting, on the end of each of the regexes, putting the same three letters.
Yeah. MS, yeah. And X, yeah.
And it's MS, like they're doing this sort of as a voodoo thing. Okay, we should put this at the end of all of our regexes because that's what Damien says to do. And without realizing that, for any regex that doesn't have a dot in it, S doesn't make any difference. And for any regex that doesn't have any white space in it because you're using the X feature, that doesn't make a difference either. So what have you been able to resolve that for yourself? Or is that never a problem for you that you just always put these ritualistic letters at the end?
No, it is a problem. And I've gotten a lot of heat for it. Even people who are fans of Perl Best Practices sort of condemn Perl Critic because they think it oversimplifies things. And like you said, it enforces this ritualistic behavior. Rather than reading Perl Best Practices and understanding the motivation behind all these people, all these policies, people will just instead fire off Perl Critic and do whatever it tells them without really thinking about why it's trying to tell them that. So that is a problem. Part of the way we've tried to mitigate that is by including really good documentation with Perl Critic. So once you get past the initial like one line description of what Perl Critic thinks is wrong, We paraphrase Conway and we try to give the explanation for why you should or shouldn't do something. Now, in order to get that information, you do have to dig a little bit. Either look at the Perl doc or you can set some verbosity sweat settings with the Perl Critic command line. But that's one way we try to educate people about why Perl Critic is saying the things that it is and why you should or shouldn't go along with it. In the real world, Perl Critic, when companies adopt Perl Critic, it's usually because there's one or two individuals who are sort of evangelists. And they're trying to infect the rest of their team with these best practices. And they usually are the ones that have, a pretty good grasp around why these policies are the way they are. And what they mean. And so I try to reach out to those people and encourage them to educate the team as much as they... So once you get management to go along with using Perl Critic and maybe even insisting on it, you have to support that with education and communication to make sure that they're not just sort of blindly going along with it like the way you described.
And also probably you should, I know your documentation is really good on this, about the idea of having different levels and having pretty much every policy also be tunable and even groups of policies be tunable about the level of severity that they are.
Yes. We put a lot of effort into configuring the rule set. That's usually the first sticking point in adopting a static analyzer, no matter what the language is, how do you choose the rule set? Because there are so many rules and it's really hard to come up with a grouping that satisfies everyone. So we came up with a lot of different ways to slice and dice the policies so that you could create you could group rules by severity, as you mentioned. You also can change the severity. So if you don't agree with the severity that we've assigned it, you can come up with your own. You can create what we call themes, which are sort of arbitrary groups of policies. So you could have a set of policies that you apply towards test scripts versus application code, because you could pretty easily argue that test scripts are allowed to be a little more promiscuous, a little more loose than your application code, and things like that. So we've given you a lot of power in choosing the policies that are in play, and we hope that that makes it easier to adopt Perl Critic. We don't want to beat you over the head with a very specific set of rules that you have to follow. We want to enable you to pick the rules that you want to follow and allow you to be self-consistent.
Yeah, and I definitely say you've done an admirable job of that. The documentation, again, makes it very clear how to be able to tune this in or completely ignore that rule or whatever. I also like that in the midst of my Perl source code, if I have a few lines of code that I want to have an exception for, you have this sort of notion of an inline comment that controls it as well.
That's right. We alluded to that earlier. If you put this no critic annotation, which is really just a specially formatted Perl comment somewhere in your code, that tells Perl Critic not to analyze the next or a region of code, either because maybe it's legacy code and you just don't want to touch it, or maybe you're doing something really out of the ordinary and you know what you're doing and you've had this reviewed or you've thought through it and you want Perl Critic to just leave you alone. A good example of that are symbol table manipulations. In ordinary code, directly messing with the symbol table is not a wise idea. But there are some occasions where it makes perfect sense, or certain modules that do nothing but play with the symbol table. And so that's an occasion where you might use these annotations to tell Perl Critic to leave you alone.
And so that's similar then, I would say, to what use warnings has, and that you can actually say no warnings with some like symbolic ref dereferencing or something for a particular region, right?
That's right. It's very similar to lexical pragmas is what I believe they're called. But Perl Critic itself is not really a pragma. It's not something that happens inside the Perl interpreter. It's completely independent of your application.
Now, we've mentioned legacy code a couple of times. I can imagine taking a chunk of code from like here at Media Temple and saying, run Perl Critic on it, and it's just going to barf all over the place. Do I just ignore Perl Critic for that file, or is there some sort of transition that can have me maybe make some headway and know that I've made headway?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. When you're working with legacy code, usually the first step is to go in and run Perl Critic at the highest severity level. So we're only looking at the really important issues, and then see what you get. And if you still get so many warnings that you can't possibly deal with it, there's another tool called Test Perl Critic Progressive. And what this does is it runs Perl Critic in a test suite. But the first time you run the test, it always passes. It basically sets a benchmark for your code. It accumulates all the warnings and stuffs them into a little file. And it says, all right, this is where your code is at right now. And then the next time you run the test, you have to have one less violation than the last time you ran the test. And you can configure that to be one or two or 10 or, you know, however much pain you're willing to take. And so that forces you to gradually improve your compliance over time at a rate that you feel comfortable with. And again, that's called Test Perl Critic Progressive. It's running Perl Critic inside of a test script rather than as a command line.
And one of the other things you mentioned, I think you mentioned anyway, I know that one of the things that Media Temple here is going to do is, if they're not already, We're switching the entire company over to Git, and I'm building the Git hooks. And one of the things we're going to add in the Git hook when we somebody does a push to the central repo is it's actually going to run Perl Critic directly as part of the hooks. Is that a common thing to do?
You're not the first person to do that. There's been some controversy about that. I personally feel that running it as a test script is a better way to go. A commit hook, commit hooks generally shouldn't block not making Perl Critic happy, I don't think is sufficient reason to prevent someone from committing to your repository. Especially if you're in a situation where you need to make an emergency release, which at those times you may decide that Perl Critic is not important. Mm-hmm. And you don't want a commit hook blocking you from getting your code in the repository. So I generally advise for doing a test script as the way to run your run Perl Critic, and usually with a continuous integration system to make sure that it always gets run. That's my own preference. But you certainly can do what you're describing with a commit hook.
Well, they also want to make sure everything is Perl tidied too. It's sort of like I think these are the easiest things you can do superficially to explain to management that Perl's not actually that big of a risk. So maybe they're just trying to catch the fruit where it's hanging low.
Yeah. Yes. Commit hooks. I like the idea. I like the convenience of them. But it's a little too easy to get carried away with them.
Cool.
How do you keep up with this? I mean, obviously, Perl's pretty stable, right? But I mean, are you constantly updating and changing things as, there are new ways of coding? How often do you have to update this?
Once a policy gets established, we don't have to update it very often. We have problems with bugs. We have false positives. Perl Critic will find something to complain about that it really shouldn't. And that's where a lot of our maintenance effort goes. The Perl Critic core, like you said, it doesn't change that much. There have been a few new operators, new keywords added in the last couple of versions. And we've had to update Perl Critic for those. For example, the defined or operator. We had to tell Perl Critic about that. I don't think we had to do anything for the given when syntax. Mm-hmm. We've had a popular thing to do now is to have modules that automatically enforce strict and warnings. Mm-hmm. For example, Moose. Whenever you use Moose, you get strict and warnings for free. So that required that required some enhancements to Perl Critic so that people wouldn't get false positives again.
Right. What would you say is the hardest thing, or are there things that you haven't been able to implement yet that you'd like to?
There's more of Conway's book that I'd like to cover. We started dabbling with dynamic policies, so policies that would inspect your code after it had been compiled by the interpreter, not run, but just compiled, and all the modules loaded in and the symbol table created and all that. So there's some interesting things that can be done there. I've thought about creating a remote Perl Critic service. We have a website that does remote Perl Critic analysis, but it's not very configurable. I thought that maybe at the enterprise level, it would be interesting to have a Perl Critic service so that you could enforce uniformity over a large organization.
Right. Well, that would be good if not everybody could run Perl Critic, or everyone, if not everyone had it. It would be nice to be able to just go to a website, say, here's my code, go analyze it.
That's exactly what pearlcritic.com will do for you, but it doesn't allow you to pick and choose the policies you want. You basically can just choose one of the severity levels, 1 through 5, and that's what you get. It's mostly meant as a demonstration piece to show the power of ProCritic and to help people, help developers actually sell it to their managers and their teammates.
So does ProCritic have any kind of way of looking across multiple files to analyze something, or is it just looking at a single file at a time?
In most circumstances, ProCritic is just looking at your individual files. It doesn't care about other modules that you load or require at runtime. ProCritic Dynamic, however, extension that I talked about a moment ago, does actually compile your module and then start looking at the relationships between one file and other modules. For example, one of the policies can verify that all of the subroutine names you're calling are actually defined at compile time. So in Perl, it's very easy to mistype a subroutine name. Mm-hmm. And there's no compile time check that subroutine actually exists. So you won't know about it until runtime when that statement actually gets executed. But there's a policy that will load up your module and load all of the modules that it loads, and then look at the symbol table and make sure that every subroutine name that you're calling actually exists somewhere. That's still not a perfect guarantee that it will get things right, but it's reasonably accurate.
So, other than in addition to looking at your dynamic loader thing, what's on the roadmap for ProCritic? Are you do you have other grand plans? If you had like 20 more bodies, would you do something much more interesting?
I don't know about interesting. Mundane. Actually, mm-hmm. I would like to rewrite ProCritic using Moose. Mostly as an exercise in learning about Moose. ProCritic mm-hmm. was born before the modern Perl enlightenment started, so it doesn't exactly represent the state of the art with Perl internally. Anyway, I would like to do that.
And are there any thoughts about what your relationship will be with the Perl 6 community as Perl 6 becomes more mature?
I would like to think that there will be a Perl 6 critic or something like that. It doesn't necessarily have to come from me. It was a little frustrating that it took so long for Perl best practices to emerge. Maybe this is just the nature of Perl, but it was disappointing to me that we had to wait so many years to sort of come together around to agree on what the best practices were, or at least have a canonical set of rules that we could talk about. I hope that with Perl 6, that those practices will emerge sooner. Or at least the discussion about them will start sooner. And then I suspect that implementing something like ProCritic will actually be quite a bit easier in Perl 6, since it'll have a more formally defined grammar.
Well, not only that, it'll have a formal compiler written in Perl that can be extended and modified. So probably Perl 6 Critic is just going to be a series of hooks that will be added in, similar to what Use Warnings does, but be directly embeddable in the compiler, I imagine.
You could certainly do it that way, yes.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, we've talked about a lot of things, but our time is just about up. Is there anything you think I've left out that you want to have people know about ProCritic?
Well, if you don't know about ProCritic, I encourage people to give it a try. Like I said, there's a website, which is a very painless way to try it out. It's also a really cool way to show your colleagues how to use it. Mm-hmm. If you're really skeptical about ProCritic, or if you have someone on your team who just will not adopt it, one of the most compelling ways to sell it, I believe, is to take some of their code, run it through ProCritic, and then find the one or two bugs that ProCritic will expose and show it to them. This is exactly what happened with Andy Lester. He took ProCritic, ran it over some of his old legacy code, and lo and behold, he found a bug. And so once you see that and you understand, like, oh, wow, here's a tool I can run that will completely eliminate the incidence of certain classes of bugs, people will really start to go for it at that point. Now, there's lots of other things that are more controversial, but they don't necessarily justify completely ignoring Perl Critic. So please give it a try and give us your feedback. We're always eager to hear from you.
Very cool. Very cool. And I got to ask the two standard questions, although I think I know the answer to one of them. So Emacs or VI?
Both, actually.
Wow.
One on each side.
I write all my code in Emacs, and then I use VI for all my like commit logs and those sort of things that are most comfortable to do like right at the command line.
Oh, okay, that sounds great. And favorite scripting language.
Undecided.
Undecided. I thought I was going to get an easy win there. Obviously, you're familiar with Perl. That's probably one of your favorites, I would presume.
It's on a pretty short list.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, Jeffrey, for coming on the show and telling everybody about Perl Critic. And I hope that people that are involved with Perl will check this out. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Randall.
That was Jeffrey Thalhammer, who I met personally, face-to-face, for at least one recent time, about 6 months ago. Glad he got a chance to come on the show and talk about Perl Critic, which I think might change the way people think about Perl, at least a little bit anyway. What do you think, Aaron?
I think this is really, really great for, especially if you have a team of folks that you want to keep the code looking the same, feeling the same, and obviously keep it within best practices. So because everyone develops their own habits. I have horrible habits, I know, because I just don't do it enough, right? And I never actually studied it in college. I just picked it up and took some courses on the side and whatsoever. So, but the thing is that if you've got a big team of people and they all have their own habits and they're writing code, and then you hire somebody else and they come in and they've got to work on this code that they don't know, and it just makes it more, it makes it easier to share and do things as a team if the code is all kind of conformed to those best practices that you'd like to see.
And a lot of things that, that Perl actually gets criticized for, and I think rightfully so, is that because Perl's been around for 20 years and gone through, you know, 5 major revisions, soon to be 6, we have a lot of multiple overlapping ways of doing things. And like we were talking about the 2-arg open earlier in the show, you know, that was sort of the handy, cool thing to do back in Perl version 1. But with Perl version 5, adding the 3-arg open, making it more, less likely to have security issues and more flexible, actually, in some ways, the 3-arg open is. It's nice to be able to say, you know, we support the legacy ways. We're not going to break Perl 1 code arbitrarily. But if you're working in a large team of people and you're working with a large code base, like 100,000 lines of code in an application, which I know they have here at the client side here, is a huge apps and all over the world, actually, huge Perl apps. It's nice to be able to say, no. Modern practices suggest we have use strict, suggest we have my variables in the right place and all that stuff. And I think I think it's good that we can have something that comes sort of, you know, adjacent to Perl to say, hey, by the way, let's enforce those standards here. So I'm glad for what Jeffrey's done, and I'm glad that it's being maintained, and I'm glad people are aware of it. So I'm glad that we got a chance to talk to him on the show.
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually looking forward to taking some of my old scripts. I was going to do it while you guys were chatting, but I didn't have the one that I just wrote on my laptop with me. I was going to take it and use, you know, put it on the website and see what it came up with. And I'll do that when I go home, just to see what kind of things it throws out at me, to say, oh, look how horrible you are at writing Perl code. But, why not? I mean, why not just check things out? And it gets you in the habit for people that are learning Perl, that, you know, that you don't know. I don't know half the stuff I'm doing. I've got to go to websites. Maybe they tell me the right way to do it. Maybe they don't. At least this way, I can just go to the website, put my script in there and say, oh, that's how you're supposed to do it, you know, and it's a great learning tool.
Yeah, in fact, that didn't occur to me until just now. But yeah, that's an education piece. It's right. Like I also don't necessarily want to read all of Parole Best Practices. It's a long book. It's yeah. You can read it in a good long afternoon. But you know, most people don't have long afternoons anymore. So it's really great then that we have some technology that can say, oh, by the way, you violated page 47 of Parole Best Practices. I think actually in the Aramis is, if I recall, it actually has the page number of the book. So if you've got the book in hand, you can definitely go along and work through it. So again, great tool for language that's paid me a lot over the years, or helped me make money for over the years. So I'm glad that we had a chance to talk to Jeffrey this week about this. And speaking of talking to people, let's go ahead and look at our upcoming lists. We have Antonio Scuri next week. He's going to speak to us, I think, from Brazil. I think he's actually in Rio, so that's one of my favorite places to go, about IUP, which is a universal interface that works over multiple languages and across various platforms. So I'm looking forward to that. Should be a great conversation. Thomas Hatch following that to talk to us about SALT, which is a ZeroMQ-based system with ZeroMQ at the core that allows you to specify, you know, many, many tasks and have them divvied up over many machines and have all the stuff, responses come back and everything. Mostly Python, though, unfortunately, but that's okay. I guess we could have a Python language thing in here. We also then have James, speaking of Python things, we've got James Tauber coming up then after talking about Pynax, which is a Python web-based framework. We'll have to get him to compare it to Web2Py since we just had those guys on. And then, of course, the big show. I've really been looking forward to this. Monty, I'm going to mispronounce his last name, Wydenius. One knows something like that. Of course, you know, MySQL guy, the guy that created MySQL, is going to come on with Kurt Von Fink, who's also one of the team, to talk to us about the legacy of MySQL, plus all the things he's doing cool now with MariaDB. David Mirza, the Vega security tester. It's a pen testing system for websites. Kleber Rosa, the auto testing system. I don't know much about that, except it's being used on very large projects. And just added to the schedule, if you're watching, again, our Twitter handle over the last week, you saw that I added Peter Hinchins, who is, in fact, the ZeroMQ project leader. So that'll be a really great show rounding up the end of the year. I will start doing Q1 bookings probably the next week or two, so we'll start hearing some new names that are on that list. Again, if you follow us on Floss Weekly, either the Identica handle or the Twitter handle, you'll see when I post a new guest to this list. The list can always be found at twit.tv/floss. It's linked from there. We have a lot of our guests on the short list for that I'm hoping they put in Q1. You can also follow me, Merlyn, MERLYN, on Twitter or Identica, although I don't do much on Identica. You can also follow me on Google Plus. I'm pretty prolific there as well. Or Foursquare, or Facebook, or anyway, you name it. I'm probably on that social service, so there's plenty of ways to follow me. If you go to my Google Plus handle, it actually has links to all the rest of it in my Google profile. If you follow me, you also find out I'm going to be in the Daytona Beach area in mid-January. So if there's anybody in listeners that are in the Daytona Beach area that want to meet up with me for dinner or something, I will be tweeting when I'm showing up there. I'm all over the net, so follow me in all those other great places as well. Aaron, where can we find out more about you?
So the best place to follow me is on Google Plus. Just look me up. I'm Aaron Newcomb there on Google Plus. You can also follow me on Facebook, on Twitter, any way that you want to follow me. Again, just like Randall, I try to push everything out to as many places as possible because I know everyone has a preference for where they like to find things. You can also go to my website, thesourceshow.org, and I promise I will have an episode up shortly. I recorded this episode over 2 weeks ago, and I just haven't had time to edit it. So I will get that up. That's the East Bay Mini Maker Faire episode. And I'll get that up very shortly. And just to give you a preview, you'll be able to see how to make a paper rocket launcher. You'll learn about how to make or grow food and other sustainable ways of living in urban settings. And you'll also figure out some ways to make some really cool 8-bit music using some old Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Commodore 64, all those old computer and gaming systems. You'll be able to learn how to make 8-bit music with those. So that's all coming up on the next episode as soon as I get some time to spend editing.
I know how that goes. Although I don't have to edit this show, I have edited my own shows before, and it does get to be adding up quite a bit. And thank you again, Aaron Newcomb, for co-hosting with the show with me. And thank you for making that long trek from, East Bay up to the Petaluma to do the show?
East Bay takes about 45 minutes. I always know when I get to Petaluma because I smell the manure. There's a lot of cows, apparently, that get trucked through Petaluma because every time I come up here, I swear I get out of the car and I smell cow scent. So.
Well, here in Culver City, we just have different sorts of smells, so it's not too bad.
Yeah. Which would you rather have?
Yes. Well, Aaron, thanks a lot for coming on the show. And as I say to all my guests every time, because I hear that music coming up in the background, we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.